as they dusted off the last time I gave a talk on this topic. And here's the cover sheet. This is in Innsbruck on the 5th of May, 2004. And you notice we have this Los Alamos logo from back there, which may be sort of bad memories for some of you in the audience. The Ideas That Changed the World logo, as some say, has been changed to will the last person to leave kind of turn out the light. So this is my group, just saying thank you to everybody. This is my the James gang sitting at a place on the east side, taking a La Porte chaga. That's all us up there. There's a list of them, two or three of us up here. It's the money that we're basically giving us money to do this stuff. And I forgot to put this on. So, state estimation of a single bit. Obviously, we've got the prototype for this was a photon polarization, which is arguably the first qubit that has been around, and that a beam of light is made up of photons, and they've got polarization, which is two possible directions, H and V, horizontal and vertical. And the state of one of them is going to be just like that. It's going to be a superposition of the two possible polarizations. How do you actually measure that? Well, you can whack it into a polarizer and see whether the detector immediately behind the polarizer goes ping or not. And what's that equivalent to in the quantum mechanical lingo? It's projecting onto the VV state if this is a vertical polarizer. And this gives you, this ping or no ping, gives you essentially one bit of information about alpha and beta. It tells you that if you get a ping, then and you've got a really good detector, then alpha is non-zero. That's all. A beta is non-zero. It doesn't give you very much information. If you do it multiple times, and you're assuming that you've got multiple copies of the same state over and over and over again. Yes, sir. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to need the hockey stick in a minute anyway. So, so you have to assume that you've got lots and lots of copies of the same state, and they're all identically prepared. Then you do this experiment over and over again. The number of clicks divided by the number of times you do it gives you an estimate of beta squared, absolute value beta squared, because these are probability amplitudes. So by doing this over and over again, you essentially get you get the value of absolute value of beta, and because alpha squared plus beta squared must be equal to 1, in turn it gives you the value of alpha. How can you get things about the phases of those two? What you have to do then is put in some sort of unitary evolution before you do this polarization, this projective measurement. Quarter wave and half wave plate, for example, in the case of polarized optics. And that is going to transform your state. Here it comes. After this operation, it's going to transform it in some new state like this. Then you can repeat this motion of measurement. You get alpha minus beta absolute value squared. You do the little expansion. You find that is going to depend on the phase. And if you know what alpha squared is and what beta squared is, lo and behold, you can figure out what the phase is. So you can get enough information. The basic assumption being that you're doing projective measurements and you've got lots and lots of copies of this stuff. Is there a systematic way? This is sort of an ad hoc argument. Is there a systematic way of doing this notion of a filter like this combination of a polarizer and the quarter wave and half wave plate, the unitary operators that's sort of combined into a filter and a detector? Is there a systematic way of doing this to measure the complete state of the polarization coming in? Well, there is, and it was done 1852 by George Stokes. Famous Stokes parameters of polarized beams. You've got four different measurements. You get four different intensities, four different values of how much the light is coming through. From these, a little bit of linear algebra, you can get what are called the Stokes parameters. And from the Stokes parameters, a little bit of playing around with the Pauli matrices allows you to get an exact expression for the density matrix of the beam, of the polarization of the beam. This is all pretty much standard stuff. You could go and read it in pretty undergraduate textbooks. This is where we came in, although various other people had done it before us, we found out afterwards. But this was a result of Paul Quiert and Andrew White actually creating a source to make partially entangled photons, pairs of photons with various funny quantum states of the polarization degrees of freedom, these two photons. I'll describe it a bit more about them in a minute. But they assumed that they had some sort of state like this, where now you've got two photons going in two different directions, so you can do measurements on them separately, and they've got two, they can be either horizontal or vertical. If you think about it, that gives you four possible configurations. And each of these is going to have a probability amplitude associated with them. Or, if these are not necessarily deterministic quantities, you're going to have a density matrix associated with them, where these over bars now indicate averages, either over the ensemble of realizations. So that's saying each time you make the state, it's going to be slightly different randomly. So when you take an average over that ensemble of states that you've made, you're going to get this matrix here, the density matrix. How can we figure out what that density matrix is? First of all, why? How do they actually make these states? Well, this is a process called optical parametric down conversion. Here you have a beta barium borate crystal, BBO crystal. You whack in a polarized photon, it spits out two daughter photons, which, if this is horizontal, then two verticals come out in diverging directions, so you can identify them. If you've got two of these crystals sandwiched together, but they've been one's been rotated by 90 degrees, so that this first crystal will do this if it's a horizontally polarized photon, it makes two vertically polarized photons. But this second crystal on its own would take a vertically polarized photon and create two horizontally polarized daughters. What would happen then if you whack in a single photon, which is at some different polarization? Lo and behold, you get some state like this, which is, just using the Schmidt decomposition, this is essentially, you can do unitary rotations on either of these two beams, and you can get an arbitrary, pure, entangled state. You can essentially dial a state by controlling the polarization of this input beam and the unitary operations on the two output beams. This is the piece of apparatus that Paul Quiert had just invented. He just got the R.W. Wood Prize from the OSA for inventing this, actually, just this year. This is where you've got an argon ion laser. You control the polarization of the input photons, a laser, just a beam of all these photons. Whack it into this sandwich of two crystals. Out come these angles, at different angles, these daughter photons. And you can do local unitaries on them in order to create the arbitrary states that you like. And you can also put decoherent stages on if you want to make arbitrary mixed states. This is this box is the state creation. And then following up, you're going to do what's called a quantum state tomography to find out what the density matrix of the state is. The state tomography is very much modeled on this notion of the Stokes, the generalization of this Stokes measurement of the state of a single polarization degree of freedom. Only now we've got two degrees of freedom. You've got two measurements happening, so we're going to have two measurement operators for the two beams. We've got two different, these measurement operators are just the same measurements that you do for the Stokes beams. So that you're going to do four for each beam, just as we'd had four measurements for the Stokes parameters. And you measure them in coincidence so that when we measure each 1, 2, 3, 4 of this beam, we're going to measure, we keep this fixed and measure four for this, and then we change this for the next one and measure four for this. You get a total of 4 × 4, 16 measurements. Those 16 measurements can be transformed just in a very analogous manner, just doing a little bit of linear rearrangement into what we call the two-photon Stokes parameters, which was kind of a profound-sounding thing, but it's just a very simple generalization. And from the two-photon Stokes parameters, you can just as in the case of the single photon Stokes parameters, you can recover a density matrix like that. And that was fine. We thought we'd solve the problem then in an afternoon. Unfortunately, it doesn't give the right answer in that when you calculate this, when you actually took away, they did this experiment, and they did it pretty soon after we figured all this out. And then they calculated the density matrix, and then we said, okay, we don't know how good a density matrix is. We've got a density matrix. Let's calculate its entropy. Oh, the entropy was a complex number, which was somewhat annoying. What it means, of course, is that the experimental noise. These are all experimental quantities. And when you just take them and rearrange them to get this matrix, you get a matrix which is not positive. What you have to do in order to get a positive matrix, a density matrix, has to be Hermitian, first of all, normalized, trace, the sum along the trace has got to be equal to 1, and non-negative. Its eigenvalues all have to be 0 or a positive number. You cannot have a negative number. If you get a negative number, you get silly things like complex entropies occurring. So how do you do that? How do you take your data and get a density matrix which has these three properties? Well, the way we came up with, and it's not necessarily the best way, it's a way we came up with. There are various other people who will argue that there are other ways to do this. We said, okay, the noise on this, okay, it's Poissonian noise, but that's because each time we do 10,000 measurements, we're going to get only there's just going to be shot noise in the actual measurements, so that you're not actually going to get, in other words, you're sampling, the number of times you sample is not going to give you the exact probabilities, just because of the discreteness of the measurements. Poissonian is a Poissonian distributed random variable. However, these are very large numbers, therefore the Gaussian approximation is pretty damn good. We said, okay, the errors must be some Gaussian distribution. We take the logarithm of Gaussian distribution, you get a least squares fit like this. So this is how we approach the problem of generating a positive matrix, density matrix, for the set of data. Here's the data that we got. What we do is we model we parameterize a perfect non-negative Hermitian normalized density matrix by a series of parameters, 16 real parameters. This forms a nice function of 6 of these 16 variables. We then put that into the computer, taking this data, we got a function of 16 variables, and we put it into some optimization routine and figure out when that's small, that's a minimum. That value T1, T2, through T16, that set of parameters, plug back into here, that should give us a density matrix, which we know is going to be Hermitian normalized non-negative, and it should be pretty close to in pretty close correspondence with this data. That's the rationale. The density matrix is parameterized uniquely in terms of 16 parameters. Well, there are various ways of doing it, but this is the Cholsky decomposition, where you have this tridiagonal matrix, and you take T dagger divided by the trace. Yes?
So I'm wondering about normalization here. Mm-hmm. Are your n's normalized frequencies, so they're less than 1?
No, they're not.
Okay, so so rho needs to be super normalized.
Yeah, there should be a normalization constant in here. Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
So did you also estimate the beam strength at the same
time? Yeah, this is why we got 16 rather than 15 measurements. The beam strength is variable. The also the detector efficiencies we didn't know, so we had to include that. Yeah, it should be normalized. Sorry about that. So here's some results. This is what the state that Paul and Andrew were creating in the lab should look like. It was a Bell state, so they're always keen on making massively entangled, highly entangled states. This is for a 2-qubit case, and it should look like this, with all the zeros in the imaginary part of this. This is the real and the imaginary part of the density matrix, and this is what it comes out looking like after you do all this stirring, which is sort of a close enough approximation It's certainly entangled, this density matrix. You can calculate entanglement and things like that. This is the maximum likelihood fit down here. This is the experiment. This is what it should look like. This is not a subject that we invented. It's been around a long time. Obviously, Stokes. It's 150 years ago. He didn't actually know anything about quantum mechanics. It hadn't been invented yet, but he nevertheless was doing it equivalently. But since quantum mechanics has been invented, various other people have been doing this. This is an incomplete list. Where I came into this was Mike Raymer's paper in 93. This is the first time I was paying attention to it when we were arguing about whether the extent you can measure phase space distribution functions in classical optics. And Raymer had measured the Wigner distribution of a single mode, which is kind of nice, using a technique akin to computer-aided tomography, doing inverse radon transforms with it. His student Ian Walmsley, who's now professor at Oxford, did a similar technique for oscillations of molecules. The quantum information folk, like David Wineland, he did this, the motion of a trapped ion. These are all harmonic oscillators, these first few examples. The first time it was done on qubits, I think, was Ike Chang in 98. I might be wrong about that. Do you know, David, if somebody else did it before? And Ike gave a colloquium about it at Los Alamos, and Paul was there, and he really liked these pictures of bar diagrams showing the density matrix, so I had to go figure out how to make them for him. So that's why we did it the next year. Since then, it's been applied to things like entangled ions. Rainer Blatt did it initially for a pair of entangled ions in 2002. He's done it for 8 ions, as I'll mention in a minute, 4 years ago. And it's also been done for the superduct conducting qubits. The guys at Santa Barbara have done this. Various other people have been doing things. As I said, that's an incomplete sample. Okay, so you've got this density matrix. What do we? How do we know how good it is? There are various measures of, say, to characterize the thing. For example, how pure it is. We obviously want to try and make pure states. The entropy is the canonical way of doing that, of course. But there's this thing called the linear entropy, which is why it's called that. I don't know, because it's neither linear nor is it an entropy. But it is. That's how it's defined. It's sort of something which is going to be zero when you are completely pure, and it's going to be one when you're maximally mixed. Comparing two states, there's also the notion of fidelity. This will crop up. If you think about it, when you've got two pure states, just taking the inner product of the two, that should be pretty nice. And if you generalize that to density matrices, it should be something like this, that you multiply two density matrices together and take the trace. However, that doesn't work if you think about it when you've got a mixed state, because it doesn't give one when you've got state comparing a state with itself. However, this thing, Richard Joseph's paper, derived this. This does give you one when you've got when row one is equal to row two, and it has all the. So this is the sort of fidelity for comparing two density matrices with each other. It's a rather complicated thing, but you can work it out. Measures of entanglement. This is a very big subject. It's kind of nice for two qubit states anyway. Here's a pure state. Very simply, you can take a partial trace and take the entropy of the resultant part and partial trace. You can show that's a monotonic function of this thing called the concurrence. This is for pure states. C is equal to zero applies separable states. C is equal to one is a maximally mixed state. Maximally entangled state. You can generalize that to mixed states of two qubits, actually for more than two qubits, any state. You can generalize this in that you can always decompose a density matrix in some way like this. This is not unique. These are not eigenvectors. But these are sort of probabilities. And then you can define an average concurrence for all of these states. And then minimizing this quantity over this all possible of decompositions like this gives you something which is a good measure of entanglement. And Wouters in 98 came up with a actual way, instead of actually minimizing all this and searching through the entire space of decompositions, he found a way to write it as an analytic form by writing out rho, this operator, rho, transpose, not Hermitian adder, transpose this operator again, eigenvalues of this, in reverse order, you get that, which is quite a stunning result, which it's still very counterintuitive. It's very nice. You can actually calculate anything. Yeah, Kevin.
Why this works.
Or you know, some physical interpretation.
Yes, no, it happened. I've tried on several occasions to try and figure this out.
Okay.
We tried saying, okay, let's do a operational measure of entanglement by saying if we're going to do teleportation, for example, how can we, with a partially entangled pair, how well can we teleport? And it turns out you don't get this measure. You get something called the, when we did it anyway, you get something called the fully entangled fraction, which is not a good measure of entanglement because it increases under local operations and classical communications. So anyway, it's still a tantalizing thing. It's a nice formula, but there's no real. I mean, the question is: yes, this concurrence is going to be one when you're maximally entangled, and it's going to be zero when you're separable. But what does it mean to say that you've got a concurrence of 0.5? What does that actually mean in practical terms? And the answer is I don't know. But nevertheless. So, this is how we took to characterizing the states that Paul and Andrew made in the laboratory. Along this axis, we have the entropy, the linear entropy. So over here, we're maximally, we're completely pure states. Here, we're maximally mixed, high temperature stuff, very high noise. Here, we've got this tangle, which is the square of concurrence. I can't remember why the squaring concurrence. It seemed like a good idea at the time. But this is a measuring entanglement. So up here, we're maximally entangled. Down here, we're completely separable. And these are all the states that we plotted that they made with appropriate error bars based on various things. But they turned out to be a somewhat overly pessimistic estimate of the errors, in fact, which rather annoyed my experimental collaborators. But still, they were, you have to put some error bars on. You notice they're clustered around here because they're always trying to make Bell states, maximally entangled states with high purity. Why it's not? The forbidden region is there's a maximum, for a given amount of entropy, there's a maximum amount of entanglement you can create. But this forbidden region is going down like this, and then it's along here. So you can have states along this region here. It's just that when you are close to the maximally mixed state, you cannot have any entanglement. Yeah. So this MEM states we call the maximum entanglement, maximum entropy, S for entropy. This was discovered by me and Bill Munro. Frankly, I discovered this bit and Bill got this bit. There is actually a singularity up here in the second derivative, which we called, we presented this at a conference organized by Bob Clark in Sydney Harbour in 2001, I can't remember the exact date. So we called it Cape Wooters in honor of all the memorabilia of Captain Cook and things like that which are hanging around. But anyway, that's this limit, and all of these states obviously fall within inside here. The reason I'm dwelling on this is we'll return to this in a few minutes. Okay, process tomography is a second cousin of this state tomography. Obviously, processes are a bit more involved than states. A completely arbitrary state that can happen to transform one density operator into another is specified by this formula here, which is called the operator sum formalism, or the Krauss operators. These things are called Krauss operators. And it has these. This is a set of operators which are constrained by this sum here. You reverse the order, and their sum must add up to one. That's in order to preserve the trace of the density operator. You can decompose this in using a set of tensor products of Pauli operators. There's just they just form a basis set for all of the operators. Therefore, this map boils down to a n by n matrix like this, which is positive emission. You get the picture, a unit trace again. Well, it's actually more than just unit trace. It's got a whole set of rather annoying constraints given by this expression here. So instead of having just normal, just the unit trace, now we've got a whole bunch of more constraints to incorporate when we're doing the maximization. But the basic idea of process tomography is to measure this quantity chi, which is a thing which characterizes your channel, your process that's happening to things. So to do that, what you do is you send in a series of states and you measure them against a set of other measurement states. And from that, you form a, you represent this data for 2 qubits. It's going to be 256 data points. You get something like this, which is this is the actual expected value of this probability that you get from putting one of these states in here and projecting it onto another state here. So you're going to put in state psi here and project it onto the output. This is the state you set up with the detectors, with your filters, and the probability of this one registering when you measure onto this state is given by P, which is related to this chi matrix. And if you set up these states right, this thing, it becomes invertible, and you can recover chi again by linear inversion. Unfortunately, it doesn't give you the right answer. You have to do tomography. Sorry, you have to do the least squares fitting again, only it's a somewhat more complicated problem. It's now 256 parameters you have to optimize over, and it gets kind of big. And you also have to incorporate these additional constraints for the phase preservation condition. So it becomes a somewhat more complicated problem. This is the process tomography we did with Andrew White after he'd broken off from Kwiat and gone to Australia to set up his own group. They did a process tomography of a C-naught based on the Knill-Laflamme-Milburn idea for linear optics quantum computing. This is what it should actually look like. This is what you measure. You can see it's pretty close, except you've got a spike here, and you get sort of these pastel shadings here, which would be zero. But anyway, and other people have done this, like I think the NMR guys at MIT did it for a three-qubit fast Fourier transform, quantum Fourier transform, process tomography of that. It just gets more and bigger and more complicated. Which brings us I've skipped over one. Characterizing processes, other things like entropy and concurrence and things like that, which tell us how good our process is. This is something we're playing around with. It never got really far of saying, for example, if you put in the ideal map that you're trying to emulate and the measured map, what's the fidelity between them averaged over all possible input states? This is one line over here, and his is more of a scatter diagram of increase of entropy of entanglement plotted against the increase of entropy, and it's looking like there's some boundaries to it. These are all numerical estimations based on the measured map, but we never got really far. This is not particularly something which jumped out of the page and told us this is the way to say how good your process is. Scalability. Well, the record, the largest number of things which have been, the largest entangled state anyway, which has been tomographized, is this 8-qubit W state, which the guys at Innsbruck did with trapped ions. And this is a 256 by 256 density matrix which they made, showing all the peaks for corresponding to where it should be for a W state. So they had a pretty good impression that they actually had made a W state for their 8 ions. Why didn't they go more? Well, this is kind of interesting. They could have, with their experimental setup, gone to 10 or 12 qubits. It's just that this recovering from and the data taking comprised sort of a few hours. It was all done by LabVIEW anyway, so they were sitting around having coffee while it was happening. But the actual numerical reconstruction of this density matrix from the data using this variant of this least squares technique took 3 weeks. And they were just lost patience with the classical computing rather than the quantum computing part of it, which is kind of a, they actually turned a bug into a feature in this regard because they went to the sponsors to say, look, we're reaching the limit where quantum computers are doing more than you can do classically. This is beginning to rear its ugly head. The point is that you've got to have, to do n qubits, you're going to have 4 to the n minus 1 measurements to make, and you have to then do optimization of 4 to the n minus 1 parameters, which is gets really complicated really quickly. So are there ways we can go beyond that? Well, yeah. Scott Aronson came up with this idea in 06, saying that you can actually get away with fewer measurements, at least in the asymptotic limit. You could you don't necessarily have to have this exponentially large number of measurements. You could get away with something smaller. Unfortunately, as far as my understanding of his paper goes, you still have this large scale. You're still full of having to search through a big space. Yes, Robin, am I wrong? Yeah.
You know, this procedure says if you want to do full stage tomography, just give up.
But no, you were also getting density matrices out there, wasn't
it? It only allows you to predict a very small set of measurements.
Yeah.
It does not allow you to predict all measurements.
Yeah. Another fix is to why are we being so anal? Why do we have to have all the measurements, all the elements of this density matrix? Why can't you get around with other things? For example, Wineland has never measured in his ANTAP experiment, he's never actually measured any, he hasn't done tomography of the qubits, he's done tomography of the motional state, but he hasn't done tomography of the qubits. It's because you can come up with a reduced set of measurements which tell you whether you're entangled or not, which is nice. So these are things called entanglement witnesses, of course. It's a whole field. There's also work which has been done here by Emerson et al. On noise characterization, that you can actually characterize the noise in your system without going through all this mucking around with the very large problem of process tomography, which is nice. But if you get away with that small amount of information, that's fine. The thing that I'm going to be talking about to finish up is, can we actually push the envelope? How far can we push this envelope? Can we get smart in terms of computer science before we hit this exponential wall? How far can we can go there? So the first step in doing games is to find a smart computer scientist, and that's Max Tresnady, who's a computer science student at Toronto. And he gave him this problem to play with, and he sort of said, oh yeah, you're doing the data storage and handling all wrong. He came up with a way of doing that. He came up with a different way of doing the optimization algorithm using something called matrix calculus. The idea being that, okay, you've got this Cholesky decomposition of the density matrix, and instead of searching the space of T matrices, you can, using conjugate gradient technique, he used the matrix calculus. That means taking the derivative of something with respect to a matrix to find the algorithm for doing this conjugate gradient technique. We found sort of steepest slope down this multidimensional curve or this multidimensional surface directly by doing this, which a part of the problem with actually just writing down the code for this stuff is it gets really complicated. And he found an automated way of doing it using that technique. The code he made available on this web page because people who were paying us to do it made us, but that's bad enough, I'm sure, anyway. So that was computer science trying to make the coding better, but it also, the question we really wanted to address is maybe the best is the enemy of good enough, in the sense of, yeah, we go through this elaborate procedure of optimization in this 4 to the n minus 1 dimensional space. Maybe that's being a bit too pedantic. Maybe we can get away with another way of making a physical density matrix. For example, as I said, that work that they did at Innsbruck with this 256 by 256 data set required 3 weeks to do the numerical processing. But if you actually get the data, and we did, of Hart and Hafner, if you just then generate a positive matrix by essentially diagonalizing it and tossing away the negative eigenvalues, then you get something which is positive. You can renormalize it, so it's a density matrix, and it's a Hermitian because the eigenvalues are real. Bob's your uncle, you've got a density matrix, to which the guys sort of turn their nose up because is it their density matrix? So is this what we call the quick and dirty density matrix? Is it anywhere close to the actual density matrix that of the state that they're measuring? Another technique, which Max thought would be better, is saying, okay, let's just find out what's the closest pure state. And use, okay, after all, we're in the business trying to make pure states, so let's try and use that fact. These both techniques give positive matrices much more quickly than the full optimization. So are they actually the states that we have in mind? The way to assess that is to do a numerical experiment, which is kind of nice because you cut the experimentalists out of the loop entirely. What you do is you choose a state, a density operator, you calculate what the expectation values for your different measurements are, you put it into a Poissonian random noise generator, you get sort of pseudo data coming out, then you put that pseudo data into your estimation code, it spits out a density matrix, which you can then compare with the underlying state that you started with. So you can actually assess how good the operations are. So here are the, this is for, I think it was a million states each in each case, for a two-qubit, for two qubits. And we plotted it against in this tangle and entropy plane that we were talking about earlier. These are, on this axis is the fidelity, the state fidelity that you get when between the underlying state that you chose and the recovered state. And as you can see, the full maximum likelihood estimation gives you pretty damn good one fidelity one, most places, except right at the edge. It's kind of surprising that these MEM states turn out to be rather funny and singular. In fact, Paul Quiet tried making them and found it was bloody difficult to make them as well. So these things right on the edge seem to be somewhat anomalous. But everywhere else, it seems to be nice and flat, as you'd expect. This is the quick and dirty results that you, again, it's not really surprising that when you are pure, you're getting pretty good estimates. It would kind of surprise us that things were dropping off as you were becoming more entangled. But as you decrease the purity, as you become more and more mixed, then this quick and dirty method goes to hell, which is, again, not that surprising. And the forced purity goes falls down all the more faster. So it seems to be that this is not such a bad estimate, at least for pure states of two qubits. Yes?
So actually, I'm mm-hmm. surprised at the point of bafflement here. You're quick and dirty. So for relatively mixed states,
yes,
the quick and dirty and the maximum likelihood are enormously different. Your MLE is almost always fidelity one.
Yes.
Your quick and dirty is, I mean, the error is magnitude higher.
Yes, like. Yes. The error is when you're getting more and more mixed.
But when I have a highly mixed state, mm-hmm. then typically tomography is not likely to give me negative eigenvalues. So why on earth is there any difference at all?
Yeah.
They should be identical.
That's true, actually. Yeah.
I mean, just looking at that, I have to wonder if there's something strange about your quick and dirty, because I can't imagine why the quick and dirty is doing so much worse than MLE.
Yeah. But, well, the thing is you've got a greater range of eigenvalues here. Here you're going to have one eigenvalue which is going to be dominant, and all the rest are going to be small. So topping out the small one, whether it's plus or minus, shouldn't have any effect. You're still going to be dominated by the large one. Where over here you've got more and more eigenvalues, and they're smaller, So, yeah, but you should, you're right, you should.
They're all about 1/4 in size,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So if you were, I mean, so if you
well,
were
all
fluctuations yeah. about 1/4, then you wouldn't expect any of them to be getting
but
chopped.
Here, they're not. This is a rank 3 state, this thing on the boundary. I mean, yes, here, they're all equal at the maximally mixed state.
Right, but if rank 3 is highly mixed, then the eigenvalue should be approximately 1/3. And again, when you're doing quick and dirty, you should
be 1 is 0.
Small. Sorry, what?
Or 1 is 0.
Yeah.
Sure.
What? One of the eigenvalues is 0.
Oh, I thought you said 1 equals 0.
One of the eigenvalues is 0. But that's exactly on this boundary.
Sure, sure.
A bit further off, you're going to be...
But over there in the 0 tangent, I mean, let's just...
I wouldn't say that I'm not standing by the results over here. I don't think there's a line of 0 measured here, which I don't think has been sampled. This maximally mixed area where you're not entangled at all. So I'm not standing by that, but I agree, but I can sort of see why you'd expect it to be falling off this way. Why it's here? Is that unreasonable? This is the results you got anyway. I don't think there's anything wrong with the code, but I might be wrong. We can check it again.
We should discuss it later.
Yeah.
Okay, I have another question. So it looks like I'm just trying to understand these plots. If I'm reading the MLE one, that upper... The red section should overlay the black section?
Yes, this is the, if you were shining light down, this is just to show where we're, because it's kind of hard to say where this waterfall effect falls down. See?
Right, so I guess I'd expect it to have kind of a hard edge there, because if those are all physical states, then it has to lie directly above that black. And it looks to me like it extends into the... forbidden.
It doesn't. All that is that when you're getting really close to this memory state, the fidelity state recovery seems to be pretty bad.
But it looks to me like that, and maybe I'm just not reading these properly. It looks like all the graphs kind of extend into that.
I know it looks like that. But it doesn't. It's just the way that things are curved. It's an optical illusion. We thought this is the best way to present the state of that. But that's why we did the black triangles underneath to show the boundaries.
Maybe looking straight down.
Looking straight down is the projection. If you have it, is the black stuff. So they're all allowed state.
Oh, that's projected then. Yeah. Oh, that's not just for to guide the eye.
No, that's all projected.
Okay. Good. Thanks.
Is there another question?
Okay. We also, somewhat more tentatively, because the parameters get bigger, delved into larger numbers of qubits to see how this is borne out. The conclusions here, but quick and dirty, seem to be that we're getting reasonably good estimates for the tomography doing things a lot faster. So this is some larger numbers of qubits. This is looking at quick and dirty tomography, looking at the fidelity. We're assuming that we've got a state and we sort of add a bit of noise to the state just for to assure that we're not that there's nothing special about the state in question. And I think these are Werner states, or some generalizations of the idea of Werner states, if I remember correctly. And then we measure the fidelity, and unfortunately, it seems to drop like stone. So by the time you get to 7, you're not very good anymore, which is sort of bearing out what the guys at Innsbruck were saying.
So fidelity is kind of an unfair measure when you get to larger number of qubits. Mm-hmm. There's so many places for,
you could be thinking of a better one
to hide. would there be another one where you'd expect, I don't know,
a little more fair for the I don't know. Again, obviously, fidelity of 0.5 you can get by guessing.
Only for one
qubit.
Yeah. Really? Oh, okay. What's the fidelity with
one over d?
1/d, okay. Yeah, sorry.
And so you're doing better than guessing.
Not much.
Because one over d goes down exponentially.
Yeah.
That's qubits.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Sorry.
Yeah, you get that.
Is this what are you keeping? As you go up in the number of qubits.
Yes.
what are you keeping fixed? How many measurements are you making?
We have to make the same number of measurements. They're all the same number of measurements, 10,000.
10,000 per Pauli or distributed over all Pauli?
Per Pauli. So there's a lot more measurements. I mean, they're not obviously measurements, they're just generated data.
Sure.
So you have two error contributions then. You have the statistical error from having we sampled 10,000 times per measurement.
Yes.
And then you have a state error.
Yeah,
this is for a state which has had, which is not the pure Brenner state. Mm-hmm. You said Brenner state.
I think that's what it said.
A state, Brenner state, which has had some mixedness because it's interactive.
But we knew. But the state that we compared the fidelity with was the state with that error.
So we
didn't want to say that there was something pathological about the states that we were using. So
it's not really an error. You're just saying we started from a Brenner state and then we moved it a little bit and we tried to estimate that state.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And so the statistical error then is about 1%.
Yes. These bars were multiple, the error bar to get from the multiple the multiple states, the fact you're adding noise.
Can I just ask how more specifically you added the noise to the error state?
I'm not sure it was a Brenner state now if you think of it.
Whatever your sort of idealized state was,
I think we just had so it was a pure state, a pseudo-pure state.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is what it was. I have to check. So his row is...
Okay, so you just added the maximum.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's what it is. I'm pretty certain.
Okay.
So you're always doing the same state. When you say this 5% state error, you weren't taking random jumps.
We were taking, so we generate this state with epsilon being a random variable, which we would have a random, would be. An average value of 0.05, lowest value of 0, obviously. And then we would do this set tomography on it 10,080 points to look at the fidelity of the recovered state with the initial state. Then we'd do this again, lots of different times. And then gives you this curve with different values and this random quantity. So that was the quick and dirty, which was rather disappointing. This is the false purity, where we assume that we had a a pure state, and we did lots of different numbers and different entanglement, different degree of entanglement as well, which again is rather a... I think this measure of entanglement was based on using a Brenner state again. Maybe it was
the tangle.
Yeah, but what's that for a mixed three-qubit state, for example? I'd have to check. I'm sorry, I can't remember what it was. But anyway, the fidelities. This is on much a different scale. So that down here is 0.9. As one, it seems to be pretty good, which seems to suggest that the way to do this is to assume that you've got a pure state if you are. That's what you're actually trying to do.
So what I was going to ask is, the state that you're actually trying to do is 95% pure.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what are you doing there? Construction, and when you estimate the state, and you impose that the estimate state must be pure.
Yes, that's right. The reconstructed state is going to be pure. And we say, what's the closest pure state to the data set that we've recovered? Yeah, and these different lines correspond to different amounts of qubits. And there is a definite trend that gets worse as the numbers increase, but it seems to be a different ballpark from what's happening with the quick and dirty. Again, so these are somewhat equivocal results. I wouldn't say that this is a done deal by any means, because it's just a sort of numerical experiment. But it does seem to suggest that maybe we can press
Gerlinger does also qubits using this stuff to full state tomography, using some of these guesses and be not entirely lacking in confidence in the state that we're covering. Beyond that, what are we going to do? Obviously, if we're trying to build a quantum computer, how do we know what it's doing, what it's meant to be doing? And the answer is a bit more despairing in that all you can do is rely on well-characterized components which you've done all the process tomography you could shake a stick at. And then if you don't know whether it's bust or not, you assume it is anyway and just do error correction out of everything, which I'm somewhat reluctant to have to resign to because it's just so profligate with the number of qubits you have to go, and it's very difficult going from increasing the numbers of qubits in the experiments. And then maybe algorithmically, the fact that, for example, if you're doing Shor's algorithm, it's easy to check whether you've got factors or not. You just divide the number by the factor you recovered. That's all I can hope for. It's a pretty pessimistic, I'm a pessimist by nature, I'm afraid, but what can you do? Yeah, anyway, so that's it. Thanks.
Any questions?
Do you put up those last two plots? Do you have corresponding maximum likelihood results? You showed quick and dirty.
Yeah, they all work pretty well for maximum likelihood. I didn't think they were. I can't remember. I don't think we did that.
Okay.
These two plots. I think maximum likelihood worked pretty high fidelity. I can't remember the numbers offhand, but it's in the paper. But again, it was gosh darn slow, even with 8 qubits and all of Max's refinements, it was taking a week or so. So we didn't improve things and lack some likelihood of what they're doing in his book all that much.
How does your students' approach in terms of speed compare with the stuff that Andrew Doherty and...
Yeah, that's another approach I should have mentioned, that you can reformulate this whole problem in terms of convex optimization, which I think he did look at it, Max did, and it was comparable. It didn't improve things speed-wise, particularly.
Semi-definite, interior point methods for convex optimization don't typically go beyond 100 by 100 or maybe 200 by 200 matrices. So you're talking 7-8 qubits max.
And that's what Black used for his?
He was using a technique that Stenek built from Olmwood's, I think,
this iterative.
Yeah, this iterative, which is equivalent to the optimization. It's just a different way of doing it.
I remember that the next day has actually two sections. One is RAIN 2 and the other thing.
Oh, yes, that's right.
It doesn't seem that the RAIN 2 actually, when you use the quick and dirty methods, doesn't seem to be worse than the RAIN 2. Because then you chop at
that's
least two hanging back.
So I say what he's talking about. So here's the MEM state, and its rank. I can't diagonalize it in my head, I'm afraid. You reckon it's rank 2 in one part, and rank 3 in the other part. And then when we go to the...
Just those coherences are maximum when C is large.
Then we go to here. There doesn't seem to be that much difference. Oh, here, in this section, you seem to be getting more errors than you do here. Is that what you think?
Yeah, and the left-hand side is rank 3.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually worse than the rank 2.
Yeah.
Rank 2, you chop 2 like that.
Yeah.
So it's weird.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, that's
interesting.
Fidelity is a weird quantity, though.
Yeah.
I mean, similar errors in the diagonal elements and the off-diagonal elements can lead to substantially different fidelity fluctuations. So for pure states, every error is off-diagonal, right? But for a high rank, for the maximally mixed state, every error is on-diagonal. So it's possible, and the on-diagonal errors cause a much bigger fidelity shift. Like if you take an error in, that's a fixed one norm error, and you look at fixed one norm off diagonal error versus on diagonal, the fidelity shows up a lot more in the fidelity for on diagonal, which may explain why you're getting worse fidelities for highly mixed states.
Okay. Right?
For the, in other words, maybe MLE has given you the same one norm error for all states, but the transforming that to fidelity makes it look much worse.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah, not sure.
Well, you come up with a better measure.
How does the balance between fidelity and one norm look for more mixed states? Because one norm bounds fidelity and vice versa. So they're essentially the same thing, but there's square difference, yes.
Yeah. So the
okay.
one norm is sandwiched between fidelity and fidelity squared.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So it can't be grouped.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Thank Daniel again.